Today's reading is taken from Luke 17, verse 5 to 10, the NIV version. The apostles said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." He replied, "If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, 'Be uprooted and planted in the sea,' and it will obey you. Suppose one of you had a servant ploughing or looking after the sheep. Would he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, 'Come along now and sit down to eat'? Would he not rather say, 'Prepare my supper, get yourself ready, and wait on me while I eat and drink? After that, you may eat and drink.' Would he thank the servant because he did what he was told to do? So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done our duty.'" This is the word of the Lord.
So, rather than a straightforward sermon this morning, I'm going to indulge myself and tell you a little bit about me and about my faith. And it's sort of related to the passage for this morning. For this morning, the disciples, the apostles, they asked Jesus, "How can we increase our faith?" And so I want to tell you about my journey of faith. Now, when I come to do this, when what we sometimes call a testimony, when we tell our testimony, I used to think, oh, but my testimony isn't very impressive. You know, I've never kind of been, a drug addict who was stealing cars, and then I suddenly came to faith at the age of 3. I was a very, very young starter. I don't have a story like that. My story isn't like that. Basically, I went to church from when I was very little. There's a picture of me being very little. I didn't normally look like that. I must say that's when I'm fresh out of the bath. I normally looked a bit more grubby than that. But as you can see, I had blonde hair and I was chubby, so I haven't changed very much. So that was me. And that little church there is St. Mary's Church in Kelbrook. Who's heard of the village of Kelbrook? Nobody. There's a few hands there. Yes, you have. That's the village where I grew up in Kelbrook. It's in pretty much spot on in between Skipton on one side and Burnley on the other. So it's just on the border of Lancashire and North Yorkshire. It's where the War of the Roses is still alive and well. Because it used to be in Yorkshire, it used to be in North Yorkshire, but now it's in Lancashire. But it depends who you speak to in the village as to whether it's in Yorkshire or Lancashire. But I'm definitely in Yorkshire now, so it's okay. I'm safe. St. Mary's Kelbrook. It's an interesting little church. So growing up there, it was a church where there was always lots of children, as there are here, with flags and musical instruments and lots of life. There'd be somebody playing the piano. Sometimes people would dance. And I thought this was normal. I thought in all village Anglican churches, this kind of thing happened. Sometimes people cried. You know, there was a sense that God was at work and in our services, and that God was with us in our lives outside of church. And as I say, children were welcome, and we were allowed to lead prayers and make a lot of noise with tambourines. And I thought that's what all small village Anglican churches that looked like that, I thought they were all like that. But it turns out that's not the case. But it was a great, great place for me to grow in my faith. And then when I got to about the age of 12, I think it was about 12, maybe a bit before that, two things happened. First of all, we got a new vicar. The bishop decided we'd have two vicars who were what was called into the sort of renewal, the charismatic renewal. I mean, I was a child. I didn't know what those phrases meant. It didn't mean anything to me. I just knew that my church was lively and that people from nearby towns would come to our tiny village church. I didn't really know why they did that, but they did. And it's because God was at work doing stuff, and it was an exciting place to be. But the bishop decided, in his wisdom, that he'd had enough of what was going on at St. Mary's Kelbrook, and things needed to calm down a bit. Just calm down. So he decided that we needed to start using, the proper liturgy and, start calming down our service. So they sent us a new vicar who was of a different tradition, and the church changed. And lots of people left, all those people that were travelling in to come because they liked being part of this exciting, vibrant family. They stopped coming. And so that happened. And also, about the same time, my mum said to me and my brother, she said, "I'm not going to take you to church anymore. You need to decide whether you want to go." Now, my mum still goes to that church, and she goes very faithfully. My dad doesn't have faith. I keep praying for him, and he's very open to discussions, but he doesn't really have a faith, and he doesn't really go to church other than special occasions like Friday night. He was here. But my mum said to me and my brother, it's up to you whether you want to go to church or not. And I decided that actually I didn't want to go because church was boring now. We weren't allowed to play those instruments and run around, and it just wasn't as it was. And I kind of grew up from that point as well, thinking that I don't want anything to do with the Church of England. If the Church of England takes something that's thriving and exciting and decides that it needs to kind of stamp on it and put out that fire and that life, I don't want anything to do with that. So I didn't lose my faith in God. I kind of lost my faith in the Church of England. But more of that later. There was a couple of marks growing up that a couple of times that were really significant for me. And one was when I was 10 years old. So I'm going back a bit now. I'm jumping around. 10 years old, there was a Billy Graham event. So this is 1990. A Billy Graham event in Skipton Town Hall. Billy Graham didn't come himself. It was on a screen. It was very high tech for 1990 in Skipton Town Hall. Billy Graham's face was on a screen. And the town hall was full. And I remember sitting up at the balcony with my mum and a few people from our church. And towards the end, they did what's called an altar call, and they said, if anybody wants to know Jesus as their friend and saviour, then you can come to the front and we'll have somebody pray for you. And I was 10 years old, and I thought, yeah, of course I want Jesus to be my friend and saviour. Of course I do. So I came down to the front, and I met a lady who prayed with me and gave me a little Luke's gospel that I still have. And that was a really key thing for me as 10 years old, making a commitment of faith. That was one thing. And then earlier, when the children were asking me about who was influential in my faith, I told you about Tim and Sally, who were a couple who moved to our village. And this was when the church had gone quite quiet, but they'd come from quite a lively church down south. They moved to our village and they said to the vicar, we'd like to start a Christian youth group. And so they did. And so me and two of my friends, it was very small in this tiny village, we went to this Christian youth group. And that was really significant for me because, as I said earlier, Tim and Sally helped me to think, not just, oh, I go to church because my mum goes to church and I always go with her, but what do I believe? What do I believe myself? Do I actually believe this? Am I actually willing to give my life, to offer up my life to God and to kind of follow his plan and his purpose for my life? Because I knew as I was growing up, I was going to have to make lots of decisions about what I was going to do as a job, about whether I was going to go to university, about, you know, about girlfriends and all that kind of stuff was coming down the line. And I need to decide, am I going to let God be part of that decision-making and lead my life? And that group, that little youth group, as I say, there's only small of us, a few of us, but actually Tim and Sally took us to this thing called Soul Survivor. Now, can you imagine coming from a youth group where there was three of you to turning up at Soul Survivor, and some of you will have heard of Soul Survivor, it's kind of connected to New Wine, and it's thousands of young people worshipping Jesus and really living their lives for Jesus. And that opened my eyes, because at school I had to be a bit underground about my Christian faith. I couldn't really tell anybody that I went to church. I was kind of a bit embarrassed about it. And then to be at Soul Survivor and all these people, and there was all kinds of kids there, you know, there were kind of the computer nerds were there, but also the skater kids, you know, and the cool kids were there. And all these people, all these young people were young people who were proud to say that they believed in Jesus. And I remember at one of these evenings, the speaker saying, putting that question to all of us, but it felt like he was speaking directly to me, saying, Jesus wants to know whether you're going to be with him. I think I was about 16. It was a really key time. And I had to think, am I going to follow the rest of my life with Jesus? And so I said, yes, I want to do that. And I had ups and downs. I had times when my faith wasn't so strong. It tended to coincide with Soul Survivor, actually. It was like an annual thing. I'd go to Soul Survivor, I'd feel like, yeah, I'm going to convert all my friends when I get back to school. And I'd go back to school and I'd sort of be a bit shy and church was a bit rubbish and there was only three people in my youth group and da da da. And I'd go to Soul Survivor again in the summer and I'd be really pumped. And that was kind of my faith went like that until I went to university. So I went to Ripon in York St. John, and it's where Beck and I met. There we are in that little photo, the one on the other side, which is, I think it was like a summer ball or something, wasn't it? So Beck and I met in the first year, and we met through the Christian Union. And actually, the Christian Union was a massive thing for me because, as I say, I'd been living this kind of up and down faith where I was proud to be a Christian when I was at Soul Survivor and I was, you know, really pumped up for Jesus. And then I'd go home and my faith had kind of waned a bit. And suddenly, I got to be among this group of people at university who were living out their Christian faith every day of their life. And they weren't ashamed or embarrassed about it. And the other people at the university didn't, you know, those who weren't in the Christian Union seemed to be fine about it. And now it was okay to be a Christian. And so that was really significant. And meeting Beck was really significant as well, because she was a much more experienced Christian than me. So she taught me stuff. And that's where we met. And then when I graduated in 2001, they closed the Ripon campus. They thought, after Phil Carman's been here, we can't continue. We need to shut this place down. That was a sad day. But Beck and I got married that summer, so there we are. That black and white photo makes us look like we got married in 1906 or something, doesn't it? But that was 2001. Graduated and got married. And we moved to York at that point because the campus was moving to York. Beck still had one more year to do of her teaching degree. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I'd just done a music degree, but I'm not particularly good at music, but I'd done a music degree. I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. I wasn't good enough to be a professional musician. And I had no idea. I had a strong faith, but if you'd have said to me, Phil, maybe you'll be a vicar, even at this point, I would have said, no way. To me, a vicar was kind of an old man who was bald, maybe with a beard, who was really dull. That in my mind, that's what a vicar was. So I couldn't be a vicar, and I didn't want to be a vicar. And besides, I'd kind of gone away from the Church of England, remember? I thought the Church of England was kind of a dying institution, and if I was going to do it, you know, I'd be part of some kind of free radical church or something like that. And when we were in Ripon, we went to Ripon Community Church, and that was a great time for then, and that's where we were. But then when we moved to York, two things happened. One, everyone said to us, you need to go to St. Michael the Belfry. And we said no, first of all, because everyone was telling us to, and we didn't like to do that. My wife's a nonconformist, so we didn't want to do that. And also, we didn't want to be part of an Anglican church, you know, because the Church of England was, you know, old-fashioned and all that stuff. So we didn't go to St. Mike's to start with. We visited all these different churches. We expected to find the perfect church, you know, where the music was just right and the preacher was, you know, good but not too shouty, you know, and all this kind of thing. We had all this agenda, this tick list of what we wanted the church to be. And, of course, the perfect church doesn't exist. That thing of as soon as you join it, it's not perfect anymore. And so we didn't find the perfect church. We ended up going to St. Michael the Belfry in the evenings because we didn't have kids then, so we could have a lie-in. And that's what we did. We went to St. Mike's, and so we joined an Anglican church. And then I was working as a porter and as a cleaner at the York campus of St. John's. And I met this man who was the chaplain to the university, and he said to me, would you like to come and work with the chaplaincy? And I said no to start with, because when I was at university, there was the kind of the CU, Christian Union on one side, and then the chaplaincy on the other, and they were two very different things. And so they didn't really have much to do with each other, and so I said, no, that's not really for me. But then when I realised that it was a paid job and that it was much, much easier than cleaning and being a porter, I thought, oh yeah, I'll give that a go. You know, so that was me. That was my beginning in ministry. And actually what I found, even though I went into it reluctantly, I loved the job. I loved talking with students and staff about faith. I loved leading services. I loved doing student alpha courses and getting to know students and helping people on their journey in faith and having difficult conversations with people who didn't have faith. I loved all of that. And after I'd done the job for a year, the chaplain said to me, have you ever thought about becoming a vicar? Do you think God might be calling you in to be ordained? And if he'd have asked me a year before that, I'd have said, no way. But I was loving that job so much, I thought, if it means I get to do this kind of stuff, you know, leading alpha courses and leading services and talking about God, if it means I get to do this, then yes, I'd love, if I get to do that for the rest of my life, I'd love to do that. And so that was how God brought me back into the Church of England and called me to ordination. So I went for a selection conference, which is what you do in the Church of England. I went to see a director of ordinance for a few weeks and months, and I got through. They decided that, yes, God was calling me to ordination, and then we took a year out. We sort of put the brakes on a little bit because I was quite young. I was 25, 6 at that point, something like that. No, it must have been younger than that, about 24. And so we decided that let's not rush into this. So we went travelling for a year, Beck and I, and we went mainly, we lived in New Zealand and got jobs there, but we travelled all over the world, visiting lots of different places, which was great. And it was also kind of like an engagement time where I was thinking, is this really what I want to do? Knowing that if I go and get ordained, then this is going to be the rest of my life mapped out. You know, I'm going to have to go to theological college, then I'll be a curate, you know, then I'll be a vicar, and do I really want to do it? And throughout that year, I spent time praying and thinking, and as that year went on, more and more I felt, yes, this is what God is calling me to do. So we went to Cranmer Hall in Durham for 3 years, and while we were there, Anwen was born, who's now 11. which is incredible. She was born while we were there, so we had our first child. So that was a bit of a challenge, becoming a dad and becoming ordained. That was all a bit heavy. Left there, and then my curacy was in Acombe, so I was a curate in Acombe for 3 years. I've got some pictures. There's Acombe in the top right-hand corner. I've got a little thing on here, haven't I? Look at that. There's Acombe. St. Stephen's Acombe. Two churches, St. Stephen's and St. Aidan's in Acombe. So I was a curate there for 3 years. And while we were there, Lucy was born, wasn't she? Yeah, that's right, because Beck was pregnant with Lucy when we were in Durham. 10 days after we arrived in Acombe, I got ordained, and then Lucy was born. When I was due to preach on my first Sunday, I didn't turn up because I was going to say I was at home giving birth, but I wasn't. But I was at home holding Beck's hand as she gave birth at home to Lucy. Lucy arrived, and so we were a family of four at that point. And 3 years in Acombe, which was great. And then I got the job as associate minister in Huntington. I didn't feel I was ready to be the vicar of a church at that point. I thought I need a bit more experience. I'd love to be an associate minister. And a job came up that was just exactly what we were looking for, exactly the right time. And it happened to be sort of 3 miles away in Huntington. So that was fantastic. And we were there for 6 years. So there is the right button. There's St. Andrew's Church, Huntington. It's another St. Andrew's. And we were really happy there. It was really hard to leave. When we were in Huntington, it wasn't like I was desperate for a job and I was looking, you know, at the church times and, oh, I need a job. I need to get away from Huntington. We loved it in Huntington, and it's been really hard leaving. But when I saw this job advertised, I couldn't ignore it. Because we've been living in York, my parents live in Skipton, over near Skipton. We've travelled down this road many times. And as we had, I've looked over at St. Andrew's Church here, and I thought, I'd love to be vicar of that church, because I've heard great things about St. Andrew's. I know a little bit about Francis Wynina, because everyone knows Francis, don't they? And because he was in York as well, so there's connections at St. Michael of Belfry, through Ian, who's the rector there, who was the associate minister at St. Mike's, all these connections before Francis. So I've known about this church, and every time we've driven past, kind of something's gone on inside of me, where I thought, I'd love to be vicar of that church one day. I bet that's a great church to be the vicar of. And then in February this year, I saw on Facebook, of all things, a friend of mine had posted, loved Starbeck vicar retires or something, some headline from the Harrogate Advertiser. And this triggered something in me. I started thinking and praying, thinking maybe this is the right thing. And then in May, I think it was, maybe March, there was the New Wine Leadership Conference here in Harrogate. Was it March? March. And so I came over to Harrogate, and I had two really significant conversations there, and lots of significant things happened, actually, in those 2 days. The first was with Mark Carey, who lots of you will know and is a friend of ours. And I went up to Mark, and I said, Mark, I hear that St. Andrew's Starbeck are going in interregnum, and they're going to be looking for a new vicar. And he said, yes, they are. And he said, in fact, they're wanting to move quite quickly, because I was thinking, you know, maybe they'll have a year's interregnum, then they'll advertise, and that'd be quite good timing for us, because we're loving where we are in Huntington, and there's exciting things happening there. And he said, yeah, and they're wanting to move pretty quickly. They're hoping to appoint by this summer. And I thought, wow, okay, well, that's exciting. But and he said, St. Andrew's would be a great church. I'm sure you'd fit in well there. And I also bumped into Francis. And I said, hi, Francis, you don't really know me, but my name's Phil. You know Ian, who I'm an associate minister with in Huntington in York. And Francis did his usual thing, gave me a big hug, bless you, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I hear that you're retiring. He said, yeah, I just retired last week. And I said, tell me about St. Andrew's Starbeck. And he said, oh, it's a terrible church. Don't go wrong. He didn't. He said, it is a fantastic church. And he was, you know, dancing around, telling me how brilliant it was. And he said, yeah, it's a great church. And he said two things. He said, go on the website and look at the website. That'll tell you lots about the church. And go and visit on a Sunday. So we did. A few weeks later, I had a rare Sunday off, just after Easter. And we came and we sat about here, actually, didn't we? And it was a baptism service. So there was loads of new families. So we were incognito. Nobody recognized us, apart from some people that I'd seen before. So we were here, and we got to be here on a Sunday. And all the way along, seeing the advert, and, you know, when it was finally advertised and applying, everything kind of kept saying to me, this is the right thing. Felt like God was saying, this is where you're meant to be. And then I came, and I didn't know whether I'd get shortlisted, because I thought, well, there's lots of people apply, and they've all been vicars before. I've only been an associate minister, so I don't have much experience. And I was really hoping that I'd get shortlisted, and I did get shortlisted, and I came for my interview day, and it was through in the hall as the interview, we had meals out here and we looked around the house and the parish. And I walked into that into the hall for my interview. I'm going to get emotional now. And and such a sense of calm came over me. I thought I'd be nervous, and you know, I was excited, and you know, I thought this is going to be the most important presentation of my life, because if I come here, I'm going to be here for a good long time. This will be where my family grow up. It's going to be a significant thing. But I felt such a sense of calm when I walked into that interview, and the bishop was there, and Bev, the archdeacon, and David, and Malcolm, and Lorna. And the first question they asked me was, I can't remember exactly how it was worded, but why have you applied for the job, basically? And I hadn't really prepared, should have prepared the answer, but I hadn't really. I had a presentation that was all prepared, but I hadn't really prepared the answer. And I paused and I just thought, because I feel God's called me here to this job. And that was basically my answer. And I thought, that's a rubbish answer, because I bet everyone said that. Of course, everyone's going to say that, aren't they? And but I felt that the interview went really well. I felt the presentation went really well. People's feedback was really good. And it was a really good sense. And I thought, this feels so right. But I thought, I bet the other three people that were shortlisted, I bet they were thinking that as well. So we went home. In fact, we went back to collect Ted, who was friends of ours, the youth worker in Huntington. He was at their house. And we went to collect Ted. And I went upstairs to use the toilet. Sorry, I'm going there already. And I was sat on the toilet when my mobile phone rang. And I pick up my mobile phone. I think, I don't recognise that number. Bear in mind, we hadn't even got home yet. And I answered the phone and said, hello, I'm sat on the toilet. And this voice, very serious voice, said, hello, this is the Archdeacon. And I'm thinking, okay. And it was Beverly Mason, and she was ringing, and she had a very serious tone. I thought, oh, she's telling me that I haven't got the job, because she was very... So she said, yes, I'm just ringing about today. Thank you for coming. I thought, oh, here we go. I haven't got the job. Thank you for coming, but... She said, thank you for coming. And Phil, we agree with you. We think that God is calling you to St. Andrew's Stabekk. So I'm sat on the toilet still. So then I continue this conversation. Where I'm saying, oh, thank you very much. And we have a little chat. And she says, so we thought you interviewed really well. And, you know, we'd like you to go on these courses and da, 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 da. And we're really looking forward to it. And I say, thank you very much, and put the phone down. And such a sense of joy. And Beck comes upstairs to find out where I am, because I'd been ages. What, are you still on the toilet? What are you doing? And I tell Beck that I got the job. And it was a really exciting moment. We're on the landing now of our friend's house. And then we go downstairs and tell them. And, yeah, so it's just been so, so joyous. And yet there's been a lot of pain in it too, especially for the children and for Beck, leaving Huntington, leaving friends and family, starting new schools. And it's been a difficult thing as well. I think I hadn't anticipated how hard that was going to be, particularly for them, you know, because I really feel called here and I'm really excited about all this. And for them, it's not quite the same. So please do be kind to them, as you have already. Everyone's been so lovely. But please pray for them in all of this. So... yeah, here we are now in Stabekk, and it's really exciting, and here we are. So this morning's reading, I finally get round to this morning's reading. The apostles say to Jesus, increase our faith. The apostles say to Jesus, increase our faith. Which seems a really good thing to say, doesn't it? What a great thing for the apostles to say. Usually they come out with all kinds of stupid questions like, oh, can I get to sit next to you in heaven? And, you know, who's going to be the first and all this kind of stuff? And when are you going to come back and all those kind of things? But this is a great question. Increase our faith. How do we increase our faith, Jesus? Tell us. What a great question. And yet, Jesus' answer is not very straightforward. I wonder how you would respond if somebody asked you, maybe someone came new to church, or somebody at work, or you know, one of your neighbours said, how can I increase my faith? What would you say? And I was thinking about this for myself. I thought, well, as a vicar, if one of you came up to me and said, I'd really like to increase my faith, how do I do that? I might say, okay, well, study the Bible, you know, come to church, or maybe if they haven't done church, I'd maybe, you know, maybe say, go on a start course, or an alpha course, or something like that, or come and do some Bible study with me. You need to, if you want to increase your faith, you need to pray, so make sure you pray a lot, and you know, and those would be the kind of things that I would say. But Jesus doesn't say that. It's really interesting. Jesus doesn't say any of those things. Jesus responds to this word, can we increase our faith, is very different. See, the apostles are saying, We want our faith to be bigger and more impressive. How can we make our faith bigger and more impressive? And we need to remember that Jesus sees into their hearts. We find again and again in the Gospels that it tells us that Jesus knew their motives. So when the religious leaders are trying to trick him, Jesus knows behind the question there's something else. And so Jesus knows when he hears the apostles say, increase our faith, how do we increase our faith? He knows really what they're saying in their hearts is, how can we make our faith more impressive? How can we impress people with this power? You know, how can we show off our faith? Remember, Jesus sees into their hearts, but also remember, Jesus knows and sees into our hearts too. He knows the secrets of our hearts, which is quite a scary thing, isn't it? We can't hide anything from him, but also it's a real blessing to know that. We spend a lot of energy, don't we, putting on a front, telling people that, yeah, we're great and we're fine. In fact, I was talking to Anwen just after Friday night, and she said, I felt really bad because people kept asking me, you know, are you enjoying your new school? And she kept saying yes, and actually she's finding it quite hard. And, you know, are you enjoying your new house? And actually she's finding it quite, but she was saying, yeah, I am, because she didn't want to burden everybody with what she's going through. And we do that a lot, don't we? We often put on a front, and we're often really concerned about how do people see us. We all do it. So we project a certain image about ourselves. We want to be seen to be a certain type of person. Maybe we hide things that are hurting us. We all do that. And it's okay to do it to a certain point. You know, if somebody says, how are you? You usually just say fine, because you don't want to go into everybody who asked you in the post office as you're walking down the road, you went into everything. So actually, I think I'm feeling a bit low. I think maybe I've got depression. You went through all this stuff. You can't do that. But actually, if you don't share that stuff with anybody, if with everyone you say, oh yeah, I'm fine, and you put up a front, then that's really damaging. It's really damaging. It's really not good for us. We need to find people that we can be safe to open up to, and hopefully those people are in church. They might be outside of church as well, but hopefully there's people that you can do that with, because Jesus knows the secrets of our hearts. He knows what's going on inside of us. We can't bring our false self to him. So Jesus's response to how can we make our faith bigger and more impressive, because remember, Jesus knows what their motive is to say it's not about size. That's essentially what Jesus says in this picture and this little story. He says it's not about size. It's not about increase. It's about God. He talks about faith being as small as a mustard seed and yet being able to tell a tree to be uprooted and planted into the sea, which is a bizarre image anyway, isn't it? But see, our faith does not need to be huge and impressive. Our faith does not need to be powerful and massive, because the one in whom we believe is huge and impressive and powerful. So therefore, our faith can be the size of a mustard seed. Our faith can be small, because the one in whom we have faith is huge and powerful and able to do anything. I remember my first ever personal computer. Do you remember how big monitors used to be? So now monitors are like this little flat screen thing here. But they used to be massive things, didn't they? They go back about 3 foot. And they take up your whole desk. And I had a big thing. I think my dad had been given it from a friend at work or something. He was getting rid of it. So this huge monitor. And then this huge box on the floor. What are they called, those? Huh? Everyone's saying it at once. The tower, yeah, it's like the tower, isn't it? So that's a huge thing on the floor with a disk drive, a floppy disk drive. Remember those floppy disks? And it was a massive thing, but it wasn't very powerful. And in fact, my mobile phone here is much more powerful than that huge computer. Sometimes size can be deceptive. And in fact, this computer, my mobile phone, is much more powerful, because while it's my first PC, I couldn't connect to the internet. Here, I can connect to the World Wide Web, and I can find out almost anything. And I can watch videos and watch films and do all kinds of things from this tiny little thing that fits in my pocket. And the reason it's so powerful is not, I mean, actually, it's just a small little bit of glass and plastic. But it's because it's connected to something bigger. It's connected to the World Wide Web. It's connected to data. So therefore, it's powerful. And it's the same with our faith. It's not about the size of our faith. It's about the size of our God. Maybe you feel that your faith is really small. Maybe you feel that you're just about clinging on to faith. That actually you turn up at church sometimes and you think, I'm not even sure whether I believe this stuff. And maybe it looks like the people at the front are so full of faith and so confident, and you're feeling like, I'm just hanging on here. Well, Jesus is saying that that's okay. That if you're just hanging on, that's okay, as long as you're hanging on. If your faith is only the size of a mustard seed, that is okay. Because that small amount of faith is in the God who is huge. And it's not reliant on how big your faith is. If your faith is very small, it doesn't make God any smaller. God is still huge and powerful and impressive. So if you feel your faith is too small, remember that God is big. If you feel your faith is really fragile, remember that God is strong. If you feel your faith is weak, remember that God is powerful. Or even if you feel, and there might be somebody here this morning, even if you feel your faith has died, remember that God is an expert at bringing dead things to life. It's what he does. He's the God of the resurrection. So if you feel your faith has got so small that it's not even a mustard seed anymore, do not fear, because God is an expert at bringing dead things to life. Just look to him. Don't worry about the size of your faith. Worry about the size of God. He is huge and big enough to deal with all your doubts and your questions and your fears, your insecurities, all those things that you hide from everybody else. He can deal with that stuff because he knows you and he loves you even more than anybody else. So the second part of Jesus' response is to tell a story. Remember, he's been asked about the increase of faith, and he hasn't mentioned Bible studies or going to church or prayer. He's talked about a mustard seed, and then he tells a story. And it's a very weird story, a story about a master and a servant. The moral of the story is that the servant should do his duty and shouldn't expect a reward. He shouldn't expect to be thanked. He shouldn't expect to get a reward, for that's his duty. He's just doing his duty. Why would Jesus tell this story when answering a question about increased faith? Well, I think it's because we are often so inclined to think that we can earn God's love and earn God's grace. So Jesus knows that that's going on in the hearts of the apostles. He knows that us reading it 2,000 years later, that'll be going on in us too. That we feel we can earn it. We feel that, oh, we go to church, or, you know, we're in the worship band, or we do this or we do that. So therefore, we should be loved by God because we do all this stuff. He knows that that's going to be the human default. And so he's telling this story to say, no, you don't earn this. You don't do this stuff so that God will love you. God loves you anyway. Our habit is often to think that if we do what we are commanded to do, then we deserve some kind of reward. But of course, that is not how grace works. The gospel is not that if we do good, then God will reward us. The gospel is that God loves us so much that our response is to obey him and to do as he commands and to serve him. If we base our relationship with God on our own worth and merit, then we reject grace. We miss grace completely. My love for my children is not based on what they do for me. So when we moved house a few weeks ago, we were packing boxes and we had loads of packing to do. And as we were putting things into boxes, Ted didn't help at all. He didn't lift a finger. In fact, he did the opposite. We'd put some of his toys in a box. He would come along, take the toys out of the box and put them and play with them and, you know, get the Lego everywhere. And then when we moved here, and we moved into our house, we were trying to empty all the boxes and get things sorted. And again, he didn't lift a finger. He didn't do anything to help. In fact, he distracted us to make it even harder. And so after we'd got through the packing, I sat down with Ted and I said, Ted, you're just not pulling your weight. You haven't helped with the move. In fact, you've made it harder. So I'm afraid I don't love you anymore as your dad, because you're not doing what I've asked you to do. Of course I didn't do that, because my love for Ted and my love for my children isn't based on what they can do for me. It's not based on whether they do what I tell them. I'd love them to do what I tell them. But even if they don't, I still love them. The fact that I love them isn't based on what they do. It's based on the fact that they're my children. I love them because of who they are and because of my role in their life. And that's how it is with God. God loves us not because of how useful we are and because of how many rotas we're on or whether we're on the PCC. He loves us because we're his children. And in response to that love, we may decide to be on the PCC and join the worship band and do whatever we do and, you know, and do our everyday jobs, Monday to Fridays, or whenever we work for God, as our response of worship. But we don't do that so that he'll love us. We do it because he loves us. So, may you know that when you feel your faith is small, that your God is so much bigger. And may you know the grace of God that does not depend on how hard you work or how much good you have done or not done, but rather is based on who you are and God's great love for you. Amen.